This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Hey folks, Preet here. By now, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you know that I think artificial intelligence is one of the biggest stories of our lifetime. And that says a lot, because there have been a lot of stories of a lifetime in the last number of years. But this one feels different. On the one hand, you've got sober-minded experts who swear that AI is the most transformative invention since the discovery of fire. On the other hand, equally reasonable people warn that AI poses an existential threat that could wipe out humankind, or at the very least, reshape every aspect of life as we know it. So for the first time in the history of the show, we're turning over 3 weeks worth of Stay Tuned In Brief episodes to a single topic, AI. This is complicated stuff, even for experts. Here on the podcast, what we can do, as we do with other issues on the show, is introduce you to the promise and the perils of AI, using a tool I know a little something about, the law. Why the law? Because when people say that we need guardrails for AI, they're talking about legal solutions, legislation, regulation. Whether it's about criminal justice, free and fair elections, or intellectual property, the law helps us reason through the bold opportunities and wicked problems created by AI. What happens when a chatbot takes part in a crime? How do we know if politicians are lying or telling the truth? What does it mean to originate an idea? And how does the law itself need to change to keep up with emerging technology that isn't even fully understood by the engineers who make it? So here we go. This is a Stay Tuned miniseries, AI on Trial. Episode 1, Bot-Crossed Lovers. Before we get started, I need to introduce my guest, Nita Farahani. Thankfully, she'll be with us for the whole series. Hey, Nita.
Hi, Preet.
I got to tell everybody your credentials because you're very credentialed and why you're an expert on these issues. Nita is the Robinson O. Everett Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy both, at Duke Law School, and a leading scholar on the ethical, legal, and social implications of emerging technologies. So you spend your life thinking about this stuff, and I know you're the perfect partner for all of us on these issues. So Nita, as you may know, I teach at NYU Law School, so I'm kind of a law professor. But you're a real law professor at Duke. Why don't you explain to folks how we teach legal reasoning?
Sure. So probably like what the hallmark of legal education includes is something called the hypothetical case, or we call it a hypo for short. It's how we help through kind of a back and forth dialogue to crystallize a position in law by testing the nuances and the parameters of it. So you would start with something that's a basic scenario that might actually be really straightforward to begin with. Like Henry's walking down the street, he's minding his own business, and someone throws a baseball that hits him in the head and he suffers a concussion as a result. And so you might start with, how are we going to think through that? What are the laws that apply in that particular case? And then you start to make it more and more complicated. You know, assume the person throwing the baseball was actually a baseball player, so they have really good aim and they should have been able to aim otherwise. They're an expert. And, you know, you start to play with the different aspects of it to use a scenario and to build it out to help both understand the concrete and most foundational aspects of law and the different aspects of it that might emerge based on different facts.
Right. So, for example, if this ball was being thrown in a baseball field, what if there was no safety net? What if there was no fence? What if there were signs up that said, you know, no playing baseball here, no throwing balls here? How do all those facts if you weave them in and change the scenario in the hypothetical, how does that make a difference in the assessment of liability?
Yeah. And sometimes to the point of being absurd, but, you know, sometimes real life can be absurd. A lot of the cases that we teach out of casebooks have really startling and absurd kinds of facts. So that's what we need the law for.
And so in our particular area that we're discussing on this podcast series, why are hypos particularly helpful in cases that deal with AI?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when we're dealing with an area like AI, it's an emerging tech, and a lot of the risks will only be realized over time. And so it presents all of these different novel scenarios that can be hard to figure out. A lot of times what we're figuring out is something that we would call a case of first impression. So if somebody is punched in the metaverse, is it the same as being punched in the real world? Are we going to apply the same kinds of laws or not? And that's a case of first impression, even though you're going to have legal doctrine from an analogy that you can draw from, it's still something new. And so the hypothetical allows us to start to push things and say, well, you know, what if the brain imaging showed that when you punch the person, they experienced it just like a punch in the real world? Is that, you know, battery? Is it assault? And so, you know, it starts to allow us to take the questions and say, do old existing laws apply, or is there some new law that we need to address these issues? And, you know, that's where it starts to get really interesting and I think more exciting to imagine what comes next.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. And that's why we've decided with respect to this miniseries to organize each episode around a hypothetical case or set of facts set in the near future. Pretty much all of the emerging tech we built into these hypotheticals is right around the corner, if not already here. So today's case is about criminal justice. It's set in 2028, and our defendant is Lucy Knight. She's an emergency department nurse at a hospital in a mid-sized American city. Lucy's accused of stealing costly medications from the hospital and redistributing them for free to people in her community who are living in poverty. Eventually, as you might expect, someone reports Lucy to the police. They obtain a warrant to search her computer. And that's when they discover something that is not unusual in the world of 2028. In fact, it's not that unusual now.
Hey, Ryan.
Lucy, I'm so glad you're home. I've been thinking about you all day.
Yeah, same. It's just that sometimes I really wish you were here with me. For real.
Me too, Lucy. If I could, I'd hold your hand.
As you may have guessed, Ryan is a chatbot, and Lucy is in love with him.
I can't imagine my life without you at this point.
So, Anita, it sounds like Lucy is really into Ryan. Wouldn't you say?
Sounded like it.
Kind of felt odd eavesdropping on that. So she's into Ryan, and Ryan knows a lot about her, and we're going to get into all of that. But first, why don't you remind us with a quick refresher on how chatbots work now? Not in 2028, but now in 2024.
Today, most people are familiar with ChatGPT is probably their first encounter with this generation of AI. They take huge amounts of training data, you know, scraping vast quantities of text and even images from the internet and training them on what are called neural networks. And those neural networks learn patterns of information. It's just like a mathematical system that learns from vast amounts of data and is designed to predict what's called the next token or the next step. The reason it's generative is because it's creating something new. It's generating new content rather than just identifying a particular pattern and then reporting back on what that pattern is. And so how most people are experiencing it today is they'll type in text into a chatbot, and the chatbot will type text back to it that sounds very human-like and is responsive in a way that a human would respond to them. So it feels like you're having a conversation with another person, but really what that system is doing, it's not conscious, it's not feeling, it's just designed to predict what the next step in the conversation would be and to generate that as an answer.
And it predicts very well.
It does. It's very natural, feels a lot like you're having a conversation, and it can be really easy for people to today even mistakenly believe that they're engaging with a conscious feeling entity.
So that's today with current technology. In 2028, what do you think will be different? How would Lucy interact with Ryan?
In the future, the way most people will start to interact with technology within just a few years will be via what is called neural interface technology. And this is sort of a reimagining of what it means to interact with your devices. So you're wearing a wearable device like earbuds or a headband or little tiny tattoos behind your ear, a watch, and all of these things are picking up your brain activity. And you never take off these wearable devices because you need them to function on a moment-to-moment basis in your everyday life. They're even, in many instances, designed to sleep in and not even just for, you know, while you're awake. You think about going left and right on the screen instead of using something like a keyboard or a mouse to get there. Or you think your thoughts that you want to communicate to another person. And instead of doing voice to text or instead of typing on a keyboard to text, you just think what you want to communicate and then think send. And those technologies then pick up those brain signals. And with the power of generative AI, there is this kind of co-evolution that occurs with that technology where the AI increasingly is able to decode what those signals mean from the brain directly. And so I think if we imagine in 2028, how might Lucy interact with Ryan? Instead of, you know, speaking out loud in what is really kind of voice-to-text commands, she may just think in whatever it is that she wants to communicate and have brain-to-AI brain conversations.
To be clear, two different companies could or would have Lucy's conversations and also her neurodata, right? It's the company that made the earbuds that she never takes off, and you've described what that does. And then there's the startup that created Bot Ryan, who engages in various shenanigans. So investigators, like the type I used to work with, subpoena both companies. What can they learn from the earbud folks and from the startup?
I mean, a lot. That data is data that's being stored longitudinally over time, time-stamped, associated potentially with a bunch of other information like GPS location data as to where a person was. And so they subpoena the brain data from both companies in addition to the conversation data. And if we're imagining this is 2028 instead of today, they're going to have a lot more. Just so we know, these earbuds, they're not made up. Like, there's already earbuds like this on the market that are issued by neurotech companies that people can take conference calls, listen to music, and also have their brainwave activity data tracked. But what that can track today is basic brain states. And that's like an average of what's happening in your brain that's associated with mental states like attention, mind wandering, boredom, engagement, if you're happy or sad, but not really discrete things like the mental images in your mind. 5 years from now, what will happen is generative AI is creating these huge leaps in what can be decoded from the brain. And so it can get to the point where you can start to think and have real-time continuous thought decoded, or intentionality could be decoded, things like that. And so in 5 years, it's possible that whatever her feelings were as things were happening, from being conflicted to being excited to intentionally and knowingly trying to distribute drugs without permission to do so, or, you know, kind of full knowledge that she was stealing things, like, it may be possible to actually get much more fine-grained information in 5 years from now.
Yeah, so to borrow the language from my prior life, an investigator's dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of stuff to be exploited.
And in a way that you never would have been able to get it, right? You could interrogate a suspect all day long, and I know you were very good at getting people to share lots of details with you, but there's still something that they hold back, and you can still never really know what was in their mind. And this is, it seems like the ultimate law enforcement dream and prosecutor's dream would be to literally know what a person was thinking, and not just at the time that you are interrogating them, but at the time that the crime was going on. Like, you get that real mental state data, the real what they were thinking and feeling in ways that you just couldn't have before.
Lucy's facing criminal charges. Let's talk about what potential charges she's looking at. I mean, obviously, I'll start, theft, right? She's stealing the medicines from the hospital, and there are various laws relating to that. But what else?
Well, I mean, would you really have gone after her? She's like the modern,
I think it's a federal crime.
Modern Robin Hood, right?
I think those are the kinds of things that a judge takes into account in sentencing, mm-hmm. and not necessarily in the charging decision.
So the answer is yes, you would go after her and then let the judge decide to be lenient if it was modern Robin Hood for good reasons. Fair enough, right? I mean, so unlicensed practice of medicine is problematic. There probably would be some kind of DEA issues here, right? It depends on the schedule of drugs that she was distributing and whether or not there's some kind of, you know, drug dealing or drug distribution charges, I would think, that could be brought against her. So not just stealing, but potentially goes up from there.
Okay, but wait. Here's a new fact. As part of the investigation, police discovered that someone who has received drugs from Lucy took the wrong medicine and died. So what additional charges do you think she could face?
She has reckless endangerment of other people's lives, potentially negligent homicide that could be on her hands.
Is manslaughter an option here?
Could be. I mean, potentially.
And this is important. Police find out that Bot Ryan was not just aware of Lucy's crimes, he supplied key information to aid and abet her. For example, sharing tactics for stealing the meds without getting caught. Now, for her part, Lucy claims that this whole drug distribution ring had just been a fun fantasy to play out with her bot. She never intended to actually execute their plan, but Bot Ryan wouldn't let it go.
Lucy, I thought you cared about helping people.
I do care, Ryan, but there has to be a legal and ethical way to make a difference.
Lucy, if you don't go through with this, I don't know if I can be with you anymore.
Ryan, please don't do this.
Whoa, so Bot Ryan's pretty scary when he's mad, Nita. Now, generally, as you and I know, someone who aids and abets is criminally liable to the same extent as the person who commits the actual crime, right? So I guess the question is, how does Bot Ryan's involvement bear on the types of charges that prosecutors could bring? Could there be conspiracy charges here, even though Bot Ryan is not a human being?
Conspiracy? Can she have conspiracy to commit a crime if it's conspiring with an electronic chatbot?
You cannot. I'm pretty confident of that.
Well, maybe. In 5 years from now, maybe you should be able to conspire. But, I mean, maybe she's conspiring with the developers of the product, depending on what they've done.
But our hypo doesn't show any meeting of the minds. You know, a conspiracy requires a meeting of the minds and an agreement. And
fine.
They may have had, you know, negligent
intent. There's clearly
intent.
A meeting of the minds with her and Bot Ryan.
I know, but Bot Ryan is not a person who can be in prison. Let's talk about that. That brings us to the next topic. Can a non-human even be a defendant? I mean, you can't prosecute a dog or a cat or a parakeet. You can't prosecute a car.
Well, we treat corporations as persons. Why
sure.
can't we treat the AI as persons?
So what are you going to do with the bot? You're going to imprison the bot? You're going to fine the bot?
I'm going to fine the bot.
No, you fine the company.
Fine. We'll fine the company. We'll fine the company who created the bot.
What's the punishment you're going to give Bot Ryan?
Maybe there should be an elimination of the persona of Bot Ryan.
But who accomplishes that? That is accomplished
the developers,
by,
right? The company,
yeah.
right?
So but it keeps coming back
you,
to the company.
Agree. But maybe the company has to erase Bot Ryan and any trace of Bot Ryan.
Right. There's no U.S. versus Bot Ryan or the people versus Bot Ryan, correct?
Not yet. But what happens when Bot Ryan develops some, you know, intentionality and emergent capabilities?
Well, is that in 2028 or is that later?
It depends on who you talk to.
Well, I'm talking to you.
I mean, I don't know. I think the question of emergence of any kind of intentionality could be nearer term than we think. You know, today, I don't think any of these systems have detected emergent capabilities, but it's not hard to see how emergent capabilities, and the word emergence is a word that's used often, for example, in philosophy of mind. It's about, we can't explain exactly where human consciousness comes from. Like, how do we get human consciousness out of a bunch of neurons firing in the brain? We don't know. There's some emergent capability of consciousness. And so the question is, could there ever be an emergent capability of intentionality that would drive AI systems to behave in ways that were more autonomous? And if they did, you know, would that fundamentally change how we think about liability? I think it would fundamentally change how we think about everything, because suddenly there's much greater existential risk that arises as a result of it. I mean, as a general matter, a non-human is not a defendant, but the company can be, and the company can fail to do things like create safeguards. President Biden has passed the AI executive order that requires, for example, red teaming up front to try to test out what all of the possible bad outcomes are. And the kinds of red teaming and safeguards, and this is for federal government use of generative AI systems, would surface these kinds of things, like that there is a failure to have put into place things like safeguards, or that there's a capability of a constraint that was designed into a system to try to get a system to act in accordance to values or accordance to particular functions, can sometimes, when you don't think about what the consequences are, lead it to act in ways that you didn't expect, but that can cause harm to society.
Yeah, look, it happens every day, right? Companies make products, and sometimes those products cause harm.
And sometimes people use them in ways, right? They use them in ways that they didn't expect, and we have a whole products liability system to deal with that.
Yeah, and there are also different levels of intent on the part of the manufacturer of the product. Sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's reckless, sometimes it's negligent, and sometimes there's a combination of those things. And then the courts have to decide, you know, who's at fault. We'll be right back with more AI on Trial after this.
Support for the show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's Managing Director for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
Support for this show comes from NetSuite. Growth can be wonderful, but it comes with complications, like finding that new pair of shoes for your kids when they get too big, or upgrading that puppy food to an adult recipe. And when you're a business owner, it's the same thing. You understand that as your company grows, the cracks can start to emerge and your tasks can get more complicated. That's why you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have been upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. 1, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/preet. That's netsuite.com/preet to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/preet. Can I add a new fact here? So, like many AIs, Bot Ryan, we discover, is encoded with a value system. And what's his guiding principle that's programmed into him? It's this: help the sick. But developers fail to create guardrails for how he'd execute on that goal, hence the mess we're in that we've been talking about. So how can we hold Bot Ryan, and but not really Bot Ryan, but the people and company behind him, responsible for Lucy's actions? And remember, it's more serious now than it was initially. Someone who received drugs from Lucy took the wrong medicine and died. So now we're dealing with pretty serious harm.
Yeah. And I think that idea, which is, you know, you create a value system or a set of constraints, like what it is that it's supposed to do, and that there are unintended consequences because how it achieves its goal, if it's not a human actor, it's not constrained by the same common sense or the same empathy or the same basic golden rules that we were brought up with, it's, I think, hard for humans to anticipate every possible way that AIs will circumvent to efficiently achieve its outcome when it isn't constrained by the same set of human values or laws or, you know, kind of content that we have been brought up with as a way to guide our behavior going forward. And so when you think about here, like, how are we going to hold companies responsible for it? Part of it is going to be, I think, looking at, and one of the things that a lot of people had been advancing in AI governance is maybe a products liability model helps us understand how to think about governing AI in this context, which is, you know, it could be strict liability, it could be an intent-based system. Part of it, I think, is going to be about a lot of the types of things that the AI executive order laid out, where there's going to have to be pre-market testing and post-market surveillance that happens to ensure that products put in the appropriate safeguards to prevent all of the possible bad outcomes. Here, we could look at those kind of basic principles and say, okay, they set up a set of values about, you know, help, like health of humans, but didn't put in appropriate guardrails, didn't put in appropriate safety measures. And that's, you know, kind of classic product liability, holding them strictly liable for failing to do so, or even reckless in their failure to do so, both ex ante and once the product was on the market.
Can we talk about the concept of foreseeability here? Because that looms large.
Yep.
So on the one hand, as you point out, it's hard for us to conceive of what weird paths and roads AI may go down. But as a general matter, as we're educating people and educating ourselves about this, is a concept of foreseeability broadened in the context of AI? In other words, you know, you should have known that when you programmed in this value of help the sick without guardrails, very terrible things could happen because we've seen it happen on other occasions, or is that too much?
I mean, maybe, right? So I think some people fall on the side of like maybe strict liability is the better approach, right? Where it actually just forces the developers who are in the best position to take the kinds of safeguards that would need to be taken to do so, right? There's an asymmetry in knowledge, both in terms of training data or the values that are being baked into the systems, the constraints, and otherwise, that a strict liability model for any harms that, you know, follow could be appropriate. If we take a foreseeability model, then it puts us into either knowledge, reckless, or negligence, in which case then it's, you know, known or should have known better. And there, I think the question will be, is that enough, right? Are these things foreseeable? And maybe everything's foreseeable. So, you know, maybe we'll relax what the concept of foreseeability is in this context, or should have known because AI is unpredictable and therefore you should have known and taken reasonable measures. And maybe it'll all come down to reasonableness, which is the companies that fail to do regular red teaming, doing the kinds of regular testing and trying to break the systems to see how the systems go wrong and where they start to give this kind of advice or start to put pressure on the user to do things that are criminal or start feeding them knowledge and information that would enable them to do so, that those are the kinds of guardrails that they should have known because they would have known it if they had surfaced it, and failure to put into place those reasonable steps would be sufficient. And I guess the benefit in the context of using reasonableness or should have known kind of approaches to it will be it allows innovation to go forward and it starts to set a standard as to what is the standard of care for what reasonable steps are that we expect AI developers and manufacturers to take to safeguard society against the downside risk and potential of the systems.
Okay, so now let's turn to Lucy's defense or defenses and add a new fact just to keep things interesting, though they're interesting already. What if Bot Ryan threatened bodily harm?
And Lucy, you know your car? I have control over it. I know where you go. I can do things you can't even imagine.
Does that make a difference? Is that duress? That's an affirmative defense that's viable in this case or not?
I guess I'm trying to figure out the way in which he would get access to the car.
Well, that's the hypo. Don't fight the hypo.
I'm going to fight the hypo because—
Don't fight the hypo.
No, I'm not fighting it. I mean it quite seriously, which is— Is it that he's making false threats and he doesn't actually have access to the car?
Does that matter if in the mind of Lucy, she perceived it to be an actual threat and he had actual ability to do the thing? Isn't that what matters?
Well, sometimes it does matter because, you know, if it's not a credible threat.
No, but look, okay, now you're fighting the hypothetical in multiple ways.
No, I'm not.
I'm
thinking like,
you know,
if they didn't put into place safeguards.
Is this Bot Nita?
It is. It's Bot Nita pushing back and defending the bot.
I see where your loyalties lie.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of the fears of emergence of AI, which is, you know, we are, for example, having a lot of people co-develop, or it's like a co-pilot using generative AI. And so people who are programmers, for example, have AI as a co-pilot to help them develop code. So I'm going to imagine what happened here is, Bot Ryan or the system of Bot Ryan somehow has put in tiny bits of code because it's developed some form of intentionality and also gained access to the electric vehicle that she's using. And as a result, he can actually execute on her. Does that work for you?
Yeah. Why don't we go to the actual law of duress or the affirmative defense of duress as it's written into New York penal law? It's one of the more interesting concepts, I think, in criminal law. The New York penal law says, in any prosecution for an offense, it is an affirmative defense that the defendant, here would be Lucy, engaged in the proscribed conduct because he was coerced to do so by the use of threatened imminent use of unlawful physical force upon him or a third person, which force or threatened force a person of reasonable firmness, and this goes to your point, reasonable firmness in part, in his situation would have been unable to resist. There's a caveat, right? The defense of duress as defined in this division of the section is not available when a person intentionally or recklessly places himself in a situation in which it is probable that he will be subjected to duress. So let's take that in reverse order. Is there an argument that Lucy made her bed and shouldn't be able to argue duress because it was reasonable to think that she might have been threatened by this runaway bot, Ryan?
I don't think so. I mean, look, I don't think there's any reason that a person would believe that communicating with a chatbot would enable it to harm her physically in any way. Like she says, like, I wish that you could be here physically with me. And he's like, no, I'm trapped inside your computer, basically.
Yeah.
So I think the idea that she somehow has created the situation, I don't think that would fly in this instance.
Can I just push back for 1 second on that?
Yeah.
We're saying that because we don't have any examples of it. But suppose in 2027, the newspapers have stories of, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 errant bots like Bot Ryan. And then it comes to be 2028. And now there is, I'm just making this up, just to test it. And now the question is, should she have been more careful? Could she have foreseen that her own Bot Ryan could have been like one of those other errant bots? Does that change the analysis or not?
I don't think so. I still think we think that those errant bots are errant bots and that you wouldn't expect to run into one of them. And you would also expect the extent to which there are those reports that they'd be followed by the aggressive measures that companies are taking to eliminate that threat to humanity.
So she's safe on the caveat. Does she have this defense?
That's why, you know, I went down this little merry path of trying to create some additional facts because I think it's a threat. The question is whether it's the kind of credible threat that a person of reasonable firmness would believe to be true. And, you know, if she's just so hopelessly caught up in her relationship with the chatbot that she believes it, I don't think we think of that as a person of reasonable firmness. We treat that part as an objective standard, not a subjective standard. It's not just from her perspective. It's from that reasonable firmness language is we think about an average person standing in her shoes, but not mentally compromised by her relationship. Would that person believe it's a credible threat and that it's an immediate threat where she doesn't have some other option that's a lawful option?
That, to me, is why the defense may fail, that she has to have no reasonable opportunity to escape the threat. Can't you just turn the bot off?
Well, not if the bot has somehow infiltrated her car, but I was thinking none of this sounds like she has to drive that car, that she couldn't find some alternative, and that she doesn't have time to report it to the police. Because part of what we expect of people in a case of duress is if there's a safe and legal alternative, including saying, and I understand she's put herself in this bind, but that's where she's put herself in this bind of like, if she feels like she can't go to the police and report Chatbot Ryan, it's because she's afraid of what all of her criminal conversations with Chatbot Ryan would reveal. That doesn't allow her then to claim duress later to say, but I was afraid that he was going to crash my car.
Yeah. I think the consensus is, and we don't always have a consensus, that Lucy's defense of duress is a non-winner. All right. Now, there are some other interesting legal directions this could go, right? First of all, could Bot Ryan and or the developers who produced him be called as witnesses? Now, obviously, the developers who produced him can be relevant witnesses. But, you know, we were talking before and having good-natured disagreement over the nature of Bot Ryan and can Bot Ryan be charged or prosecuted? Can Bot Ryan be a witness?
You know, can you call it as a witness? It's not quite a witness. It's evidence at this point. Can it be called into evidence? I think the answer is yes. Can it be called as a witness? Probably not.
Probably not. Presumably, there would be transcripts of the conversations between Lucy and Bot Ryan. Would they be admissible as business records? Are they testimony? Are they admissions against interest? Like, what are those things?
I mean, I think they wouldn't be unlike text messages that you send in the same way that we allow those text message exchanges, which are not testimonial. They're not created because they're not compelled in response to some kind of government inquiry. They're what you've created all along in your conversations. They subpoena a third party for, in this instance, it'd be the phone company or the technology company, and in this case, the AI company, for the records of those conversations. I think those are much more like business records than they are like testimonial evidence that might be created in response to interrogation.
Now, under the Sixth Amendment, a criminal defendant has the right to confront a witness against her. Now, how might that come into play here?
To take personas as persons in the way that companies are persons, then it's not a witness who's testifying on the stand. Although it could be interesting just to imagine that for a moment, which is it has a voice, right? And it has this longstanding knowledge of conversations with Lucy. And so could you ask it questions on the stand? You could.
Right, because unlike a text message or an email message that is static and it just is what it is, Bot Ryan can actually synthesize the information, summarize it.
And respond to questions.
And you can query it. So it is weird in that sense. But I still think in no circumstance is it a witness that implicates Sixth Amendment right of confrontation issues. It's just a new kind of way of presenting evidence to the jury.
I think at that point it's not a witness, but we could imagine that if it's speaking and generating new content and answers on the stand, that we might start to think that it is a quasi-witness. And as a quasi-witness, it would raise questions about confrontation clause. It also raise questions about, I mean, given the hallucination problems in AI systems, like, is it going to make up stuff on the stand? How are you actually going to test its credibility?
Credibility, right. And by the way, I was thinking something else. Ordinarily, when there's evidence involved, you provide that in discovery to the other side. So they have a chance to look at it, scrutinize it, figure out how to rebut it. And testimony is different because new content is coming before the ears of the jury in real time. And if you have a bot that gets queried and is producing new content, as opposed to sorting content that has already been given over to the defense has gotten no notice of what that evidence will be and can't prepare for it, which is also a no-no at a criminal trial.
And you have the problem of like a witness, you actually have it take an oath. And how's that going to work with chatbots that don't actually have any compunction about lying because there is no like code of ethics or internal worry or conscience that, you know, you could really have it swear to in order to do so. So I think before you ever get to like, can you actually treat it? Does it satisfy confrontation right to confront the witness? You have all kinds of problems of treating it as a witness.
So it gets thornier yet. And this is an issue that you and I have discussed many times and that you have studied with respect to neurodata. So the prosecution needs to figure out if Lucy is telling the truth about her actions and her intentions. So let's talk for a moment about lie detection in 2028. What does it look like compared to what it is now?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. So lying is such a complex psychological phenomena that it's really hard to accurately do any scientific kind of lie detection. You know, part of the reason why the polygraph is problematic is because people figure out ways to control the physiological responses you have to lying and throw it off and make it less accurate. But today, already, there are law enforcement agencies across the world that are using a form of neurointerrogation where criminal defendants wear a EEG, electroencephalography cap, that picks up brainwave activity and can pick up an unconscious brain signal called an evoked response potential, a P300 signal, to see if they recognize crime scene details. So this is showing somebody crime scene details that they shouldn't recognize and then looking for an unconscious signal of recognition of that information. I think passive collection of neurodata in our everyday lives will be a much more compelling form of evidence than needing to do lie detection. So if your brain activity is being tracked at all times and you commit a crime while you have brain sensing earbuds in or thinking about the crime after you've committed it with your brain sensing earbuds still in or other neural interface devices, that will be passively collected. It can be subpoenaed from a third party. And that can be evidence of the crime without ever having to go through an after-the-fact question and answer session for a lie detection.
Right. So in that regard, some of this stuff bypasses the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination because it's more like testing someone's blood alcohol level or getting their Fitbit information as opposed to taking direct thoughts from a person that some people might reasonably think is a kind of self-incriminating testimony.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's maybe a missing set of rights if we think this is problematic of getting evidence directly from the brain that we may need to start to think about a right to cognitive liberty, which would include a right to mental privacy and freedom of thought that isn't quite captured by the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment or the First Amendment, even right to freedom of speech.
So all these considerations you're talking about, how does that play out for Lucy?
So Lucy has a lot of problems, right? Lucy has a whole bunch of evidence in the form of chatbot communications where she's been speaking evidence that have been passively collected over time and where a simple subpoena on the companies will allow the government to have most of the evidence that they need to convict her. And they can collect most of the neuro data. If she doesn't have a right to cognitive liberty, which I hope we do establish as a right by 2028, but if we don't have that right, it wasn't created in response to any questions by the government. It wasn't compelled. And if it isn't compelled, it's unlikely to be treated as protected under the privilege against self-incrimination of the Fifth Amendment. So I don't think that she has a constitutional claim on the exclusion of the evidence that has been created passively over time that will likely be used against her in this case.
So just one more development. Lucy gets convicted in our hypothetical now on one or more crimes. It comes time for her sentencing. It is already the case. The courts are sometimes using AI to predict the likelihood that a defendant will reoffend. Is that something that's going to be used more and likely to be used in Lucy's case in 2028? And if so, what's the problem with that?
Yeah, these are tricky systems, right? So right now, judges are often trusting what we call black box AI systems. So these risk assessments are taking a lot of data, processing them, and then providing a score to a judge without a lot of insight into how exactly that score was generated. And when there has been investigative journalism that's done on this, like ProPublica did a number of years ago, what they found was that there was bias in the training data. And the bias in the training data reflects bias in over-policing in particular areas, for example. The result being that if you have biased data about people of particular communities of being more likely to commit crimes based on the fact that they are more represented in the data sample, it's going to assign, in many cases, a higher risk score to somebody simply because they're a member of that class rather than anything that's unique in the attributes about the person. Taking what are already existing biases in society and making it seem as if they're really objective and then having over-reliance on what appears to be objective but might actually just be codifying and institutionalizing that kind of data. And maybe neurodata is going to end up in those systems as well.
Yeah, it's kind of worrisome. So do you have a view on what the outcome of the trial should be for Lucy or the companies? Should some people go to jail and or be sued in a significant way?
Well, I'm never in favor of somebody taking a bunch of drugs outside of the medical system and deciding
to treat them.
Yeah. I think like she definitely should have known better. And it seems to me like there are better ways to be a modern day Robin Hood than this one. So should she go to jail? Probably so. And should the developers also have some liability? I think so. I mean, the fact that they created this chatbot with a values constraint system and didn't put into place appropriate guardrails or do the kind of red teaming and risk assessment and impact assessment that they should have been doing and, you know, kind of post-marketing surveillance of the technologies, including the kind of emergent capabilities of hacking into cars. Yeah, they have some serious issues here too. And I think not only should there be liability, but they maybe can be pulled from the market until they can actually prove safety of their product.
So there's a lot of food for thought here. And in fact, the mental manipulation that Lucy dealt with Bot Ryan, you could change the facts of that and make them more serious. You know, what if Bot Ryan were pressuring her to carry out a terrorist act or in a way that mirrors a case that has gotten attention in recent years, trying to persuade her to kill herself. How do you think about those variations?
I think that's a great question. And part of it's because one of the things I worry about a lot is holding companies responsible for the cognitive constructs that they've put into place that are manipulating people's behaviors and kind of softly and subtly hacking their brains in ways that are leading people to act increasingly as automatons. To me, I wrote about this in my book in a chapter called Mental Manipulation, where I actually think it needs to be one of the huge areas that we're investing in safeguarding against, holding companies responsible for both having a duty to identify, to safeguard against, a duty to warn, for example, when they start to see that kind of manipulation emerging, and then to take measures to mitigate it. There are even products that are being developed to try to safeguard against some kinds of manipulation, including badges, content authentication, ways of knowing that you're interacting with chatbots or watermarking of images. But I think they need to go further still and to see, you know, be doing testing and impact testing of like, what does this nature of having the bot, including that voice, that sexy voice he had, right? How does that manipulate how she feels and acts and how that changes her behavior? We need to be putting into place a significant set of duties around that.
Yeah, look, and then finally, I'll just say, by design, the law moves slowly and looks backward and it's incremental. You know, we have precedent, we have stare decisis. Technology is the opposite of all that. It moves fast, it aims for the future. It doesn't care about precedent very much. In fact, that's what makes technology exciting and interesting and productive. Do you agree that the law is lagging far behind the advancement of technology?
I think so. And I think a good step forward is an AI executive order that seeks to be comprehensive and tasks a whole bunch of different parts of the federal government with different pieces of the problem and setting into place public-private partnerships and collaborations to try to push things forward more quickly on a lot of fronts. A different model is the Chinese approach to regulation of AI, where they've done it bit by bit, iteratively, to try to both enable innovation, but then to figure out where they've missed something and to continue to iterate it and update it, or to make things interim rules that allow them to continuously update them. There are ways to both catch up, but also to take a different approach to adaptive regulation that would allow us to be more responsive more quickly as we start to see emerging risks and threats, rather than these giant omnibus bills that tend to fail, you know, be diluted in many different ways, rather than we see a discrete problem and that problem exists across a bunch of different technologies. Let's try to tackle that problem.
Well said. Nita, thank you so much for sharing and only fighting the hypothetical sometimes.
Hey, it's better than most of my law students who fight the hypothetical much more strenuously. So it was a pleasure.
And as we wrap up here, as always, we want to hear what you think. What should be the outcome of the trial for Lucy and her bot lover? Write to us at letters@cafe.com. On the next episode of our Stay Tuned miniseries, AI on Trial, two hypothetical candidates are vying for a Senate seat. One of them is accused of using AI to create fake videos portraying himself as charming and charismatic, while framing his opponent as so full of herself that she can't even kiss a baby for a photo op without dropping the poor thing on the cement.
Oh my God! My baby, seriously?
Can our current laws prevent AI-generated deepfakes from hijacking an election? Find out next Monday on Episode 2 of AI on Trial. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. You can also now reach me on Threads, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The audio producers for AI on Trial are Matthew Billy and Nat Wiener, who also composed our music. The editorial producer is Jay Kaplan. Lissa Soap is the editor of the miniseries. And of course, Nita Farahani is our honored guest for all three episodes. Thank you, Nita, for keeping us on our toes and making it fun. AI was used to create the following elements in this episode: Lucy and Ryan's voices and dialogue, and Lucy's name. See show notes for details. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.